Birmingham, Alabama, this is ARC Stories Radio. The stories you're about to hear are true, personal, and told by the people who live them in front of a live audience at one of our ARC Stories events.
I said, Chelsea, do you want to have your baby at the hospital? She said, yes. I said, then we need to go. And then I said, we need to go now.
I'm Taylor Robinson, and today we have four stories about people trying to navigate through some major dilemmas.
Now, all of a sudden, my math on Aunt Claudine and Aunt Wilma did not add up to my family's math, and I was intrigued because I had my own little secret that I had not let my family know about. And I really wanted to know how they were coping with this.
We created ARC Stories to give Birmingham a place to tell its stories to the world. So coming up after the news, Birmingham's own true stories. Welcome to ARC Stories Radio. I'm Taylor Robinson, ARC Stories Director, and I'm joined by my co-host and story coach, Chris Kinsley.
Today we have four stories, each recorded throughout Birmingham at different ARC Stories events. They include a young man trying to discover a family secret, a girl coming to grips with the loss of her mom, and a woman who finds herself completely exposed outside of a stranger's house.
All of the stories we feature are true, at least as true as our storytellers can remember. We do this because we think real life is better than fiction, and some of the best drama can be found in everyday life. Take childbirth, for example. Most everyone is familiar with the process, yet it continues to be exciting. And it's not just for the parents to be, it also keeps everyone around them completely engaged. And that is certainly true for our first story. It was recorded at an event that was held at the Avon Theater around Mother's Day, where the theme was Wonder Women, Stories About Moms. Here's storyteller Kaylee Naylor.
It was the second Tuesday in March of 2014, and I know it was the second Tuesday because I was going to Birth Stories, which is a group that I help facilitate, and I had gotten a call from a mom that morning saying, I think something's going on, I'm not really sure, we'll be in touch. And I got to Birth Stories and I realized I didn't have my phone and I have this mom percolating and it's a really big deal if you're a doula and you don't have your phone, that's your whole business. So I rushed home with two kids and as soon as I walked in the door, we kind of got settled and 10 minutes later, I got a call from the mom again and she said, oh, I think my water's broken. I was like, okay, so today is probably the day. Could be tomorrow, you never know, birth's unpredictable. But I said, that's great. I said, you know, how are you feeling? You ready for me to come and be with you? She said, no, I'm driving, I'm going to get my daughter from daycare. I'll let you know. I was like, okay, that's unusual. But I guess that was probably about noon. But about 20 minutes after I got that call from her, I got a call from her husband. So if you're not a doula, you should know that when you get a call from the husband after you've been talking to the wife or from mom's other support people, that things are starting to get a little more serious. So he's talking to me, and we're trying to say, okay, you know, he said, I think she's ready for you to come over. She's just in the tub. It's very relaxed. And I was like, okay, so I can probably be there in about 30 minutes, you know. And then I hear her in the background going like this. I said, do you want me to just meet you at the hospital? It sounds like, you know, if that's her, and they don't have, like, you know, cows or anything. But it's a sound that moms make in labor when it's about time to go to the hospital if you want to have the baby in the hospital, and most people here do, and this is an important thing to note. Anyone who helps a mom have a baby out of the hospital in Alabama could go to jail, and I'm not interested in going to jail, and most people aren't interested in going to jail, so it's very important that we try to get to the hospital to have the baby. And that's what she wanted to do, so that's what I wanted to help her do. Anyway, he said, no, she really wants you to come here first. I said, okay. So my husband and I cross each other. You know, he's coming and I'm going out. I gun it across town. Her mother-in-law meets me at the front door, And she says, oh, I'm so glad that you're here, because I think she's really hurting. And so I said, okay, we'll see how things are going. And I walk in the front door, and she's sort of leaning on the back of the love seat in her living room, face is flushed, and she's looking down. I think a contraction had just ended, and she cuts her eyes at me, like, really wide. She's like, I think I'm going to have an epidural. And I said, I can't give you an epidural. We're going to have to go to the hospital for that. And then I noticed her husband stood up, and he didn't have a shirt on. And that's unusual, too. And he said, well... It's like, I'll just go get dressed, and then we can go. And I said, good, that sounds great. And so... So he's gone. But anyway, so I'm sitting there with her, like kind of kneeling on the ground, and she's trying to help her to get into a comfortable position while we're waiting to go to the hospital so the baby can come out. So helping her get into a position, she gets on her side, and the next contraction, sort of at the peak, because they're kind of like a wave. So at the peak, she goes, and I was like, in my mind, I said, oh, if you don't know what that sound means, it means that the mom is starting to push when she's not medicated. Okay, as I said, okay. I said, Chelsea, do you want to have your baby at the hospital? She said, yes. I said, then we need to go. Still just me and her, though. Okay, so I ran around the house like a crazy person. I said, hello. And I'm trying to be nice. I'm trying to be nice. Because, you know, doulas, what we do when we come in, like, we take the energy down and we calm everybody down. But there was not enough stress in this situation. So I said, we need to go. And then I said, we need to go now. And so finally, so I hear someone, and then, but I was like, they sound far away. I cannot wait for them. So I run back to her, and I get her off the couch, and we're kind of like slow dancing baby steps to the door, okay? We get to the doorstep, like the doorway, where like I'm out, and she's in the house, and she cuts her eyes at me again, and she says, I want to ride with you. And at that point in my career, I had never had anyone in my car in labor before except for me. And I haven't had anyone in my car since. But I knew that this was serious. So another thing that you need to know is that her husband is legally blind and he does not drive. Her mother-in-law, the reason she was there is she was going to be taking them to the hospital. So this was her second baby, and the plan was that she was going to drive them and that her mother was going to come and stay with their older child. Because their first birth had been kind of long, and I think there's an expectation that this would be the same. But at this point, this is about an hour since her water's been broken. So it's going a little faster. So no one else to stay with the older daughter. So mother-in-law's got to stay with the older daughter. And mom, she did not feel safe riding with her husband, who does not normally drive. So I said, okay. Because she had this very, it was a very serious look, you guys. It's like this look that moms get. It says, I am in labor, and this is the truth. So I'm like, I had all this junk in the back seat of my car, like, so I'm like scraping it off the back so she can get in, and so she climbs in, and her husband's walking out the door with his shirt on. It's important. And I said, hey, there's plenty of room in the back, but you can ride up front with me too if you want. He said, oh no, I think she really wants to have a car there, so I'm gonna drive. And I was like, see ya. So I gunned it out of their driveway and have it mapped out on my phone, because I haven't driven from this part of town to this particular hospital before, and it says 10 minutes. And I was like, no, we're going to make it in 7 to 8. And And I also realized, I was like, oh my gosh, this is going so fast. I don't know if they've had a chance to call the doctor. So I called one of my doula partners. I said, can you please call this hospital and let them know that we're coming? And then here's the mom in the back going, and I said, and she is pushing, so they need to have a chair ready for us, please, please. And so we're driving, and I'm cutting around cars, and she's in the back seat going, oh, and I'm like, okay, just breathe out with that pressure, okay? Nice, slow breaths. But in here, I'm thinking, oh my God, like, where can I pull my car over? Like, starting to think like 100 feet ahead, like, if I have to deliver this baby, it's like, do I have any hand sanitizer? Crap, I don't have any gloves. What am I gonna do? So, finally, we were 2 minutes, I'm just talking, I was like, okay, 5 minutes. We got 3 minutes to go. Breathe out. I'm trying. Guys, you're doing great. So we pull into the hospital parking lot, and I have flashers going, and I tear open the back door, and she said, I don't think I can get up. And I was like, I think you can do it. There was not a chair waiting for us. Like, I hoped there would be. There was nobody. It was deserted. It was just the two of us. So here we go again, through the door, and we made it to in front, right in front of the elevators to go up, and we got stuck. Not in the elevator. We didn't get stuck in the elevator, but she was not taking another step, and that was it. I was like, okay, all right. I was like, okay, we're here. I was like, we just have to press the button. And finally, someone, like a maintenance worker came up, and she said, do you need help? And I said, yes! Because her husband still wasn't there yet. It was just us. She said, okay, I'll call upstairs to get a chair for you. That would be great. I said, thank you so much. And so we'd have a couple more contractions there. And I'm thinking, okay, if I have to get down on the floor to, like, you know, if the baby starts to come, then, you know, I was like, I can do it. I don't want to do it, but I can do it. But finally... like there's this whole team of nurses with a chair, and the dad is walking behind them, and I'm like, yes! It was the most exciting moment of my life. But it was really exciting. So they get her in the chair, and they take her upstairs, and I parked my car because I didn't want to get towed, and I made it upstairs. I think I might have teleported. I have no memory of, like, going up the elevator or anything. But about 20 minutes after we got into the room, that beautiful baby was born. So we made it. Afterwards, she was like, you know, had the baby, and I was like, oh my gosh, I'm really worried that she is going to be traumatized by this, because sometimes we're not expecting to have a two-hour labor. It's kind of traumatizing. You didn't get to do all those things you wanted to do, like, you know, play your music and have your aromatherapy. But I looked over at her, and she was beaming, and she looked beautiful, and she said, I can't believe I just did that. I said, of course you did. Thank you.
In addition to serving families as a doula, Kaylee Naylor is also a wife and a mother of two kids of her own. You can find her and learn more about her services at birthwiseinbirmingham.com.
When my wife and I had our daughter, we didn't choose to have a doula, but I can see the appeal. You know, when you're first-time parents, you definitely feel like you are flying blind, and there would be real benefit to having someone right there by your side the entire time, who not only knows exactly what's going on, but is also supposed to make you feel really good about it.
Yeah, but that can be a doctor or a nurse or somebody, right?
I guess, but you know, they're so professional that they can unintentionally feel completely separate from you in a lot of ways. I think for those who choose a doula, she still feels very much like a regular person. Only she somehow figured out the secrets of birthing a baby. Plus, you know, she's been with you for much longer. Know what I mean?
Do I know what you mean about the doula versus doctor thing?
Yeah.
Kinda. But I do get what you mean about having someone around who's figured out most of the secrets. And we can all see the benefit from something like that. And that is for sure true with our next storytellers. Only the secret he's looking for are about his family. Hear them in just a moment on ARC Stories Radio, Birmingham's own true stories. This is ARC Stories Radio. We're bringing you true, personal stories told live in front of an audience right here in Birmingham by the people who live there. I'm Taylor Robinson, the director of ARC Stories.
And I'm story coach Chris Kinsley. With the holidays approaching, many of us will be spending much more time with our families than we're used to. And part of that preparation is ensuring we know all the subjects that are off limits. You know, those things our family members just do not want to talk about. However, in our next story, our teller completely ignores that convention. It's from an event we did in partnership with the Birmingham Museum of Art and our friends at The Moth, where the theme was storytelling and Southern identity. Here's storyteller Leonard Lee Smith.
Aunt Claudine and Aunt Wilma were my two old spinster aunts. They lived together in a house on Windsor Street. Aunt Claudine was my grandmother Ruby's baby sister. They were integral in my family and at every event. Aunt Claudine was tall and mannish and loud and very crippled with rheumatoid arthritis. Her hands were misshapen, her feet were misshapen, and she had a very crippled kind of walk. She'd also lost her hearing, and whenever you hugged her, her hearing aids would whistle in your ear. Aunt Wilma was petite and doll-like, well manicured, very quiet, and wore her hair in a perfect little globe of white waves that she always kept a hairnet on. Aunt Claudine was Baptist and went to First Baptist Church. Aunt Wilma was Methodist and went to First Methodist Church. Even though she was crippled and deaf, Aunt Claudine did all the driving because Aunt Wilma had never learned to drive. I was tight with them, and when I moved off to California as a child, I called them as often as I called Granny Ruby. But the spring that I graduated high school, I learned a very important thing about Aunt Claudine and Aunt Wilma and my family. My mother came in one day and whopped a book down on the table, and she said, "I picked that up at the library. It's a handbook on etiquette. You're going to read the section on invitations. Every day, you're going to address 5 invitations. At the end of 2 weeks, you will have all of your high school graduation invitations done." I knew I wasn't going to get out of this, and so I reluctantly complied. She came in one afternoon and picked up the invitation I had addressed to Aunt Claudine and Aunt Wilma. "You cannot send this invitation this way," she said. I said, "Mother, it says right there in that handbook that you can send one invitation to 2 people of different names at the same address, provided those people are related." She said, "That's correct. That's why you can't send this. Aunt Wilma and Aunt Claudine are not related. Aunt Wilma is not related to us." I said, "Mother, what are you talking about?" She said, "Aunt Wilma is a Ryle. She's not a Watkins or a Barrington, and we're not related to the Ryles." I said, "Mom, every time that we go through Brundage with Granny or Aunt Claudine, we stop and have lunch with Mr. Knox Ryles, Wilma's brother. Of course we're related to the Ryles." She said, "Mr. Knox is a very nice man, and we enjoy visiting him, but we are not related to the Ryles." I said, "Mama, you're not making any sense. How can Aunt Wilma be Aunt Wilma if we're not related to her?" My mother got very annoyed and said, "I'm tired of answering questions. Fill out 2 invitations, one to Miss Claudine Watkins and one to Miss Wilma Riles." I said, "What do you mean, Miss Wilma Riles? I thought Aunt Wilma had been married once upon a time." She said, "They've never been married. They're 2 old spinsters who moved in together over 40 years ago. Fill out 2 invitations and hush." Now, all of a sudden, my math on Aunt Claudine and Aunt Wilma did not add up to my family's math, and I was intrigued because I had my own little secret that I had not let my family know about. And I really wanted to know how they were coping with this. Now, you know how you have that one person in your family who will tell you the truth? Mine was an uncle, and I went to him with my math on Aunt Claudine and Aunt Wilma. I didn't get the response I expected. He looked at me as if I had broken wind at the dinner table. He said, "Why would you want to talk about that?" I learned never tread on the denial of a Southern family. They have done their mental somersaults. They do not want to have to do it again. I moved back to Alabama, and I did a lot with Aunt Claudine and Aunt Wilma and Granny Ruby. They were kind of a trio, and we got pretty tight. And then in my mid-20s, Aunt Wilma got sick. She was well into her 80s, and she had congestive heart failure. And she took to her bed, and Aunt Claudine nursed her and took care of her, and Granny Ruby would go over and help her, and my aunts and uncles would visit. And then she succumbed to her illness, and she died. Aunt Claudine took care of the funeral arrangements, got her a big brass coffin, spared no expense. But no matter how elaborate your funeral is, it makes no difference if there's no one to attend it. And Aunt Wilma only had one relative, Mr. Knox. He had no children. So my family came forward, and we were the family that buried her. My cousins and I were her pallbearers. Over 50 of us attended the funeral. We formed her funeral cortege and followed the hearse from Montgomery to the cemetery in Brundage. After the funeral, we went to Mr. Knox's house and had the big meal that Southerners have after a funeral. Aunt Claudine was proud that we were there, and Mr. Knox was proud that we were there. After that, everybody went back home to their lives, and Aunt Claudine went back to the house on Windsor Street by herself. And I would call her in the evenings and ask her if she wanted company. She usually did. She told me that she was having trouble sleeping now that she was in the house alone. And I would go visit her, and I often took my friends. And with me and my friends, Aunt Claudine understood, without it being spoken, that she could let her weight all the way down and be who she was, and that was a grieving widow. She told us how much she'd loved Wilma and how much she missed her. One of my friends one evening asked her a question. He said, Miss Watkins, how did you and Wilma meet? She said, oh, we were girls. We grew up near each other, and we got to know each other as young women. He said, did you know you would spend your life with Wilma? She said, well, I always wanted that to happen, but I didn't know exactly how Wilma felt about that, but that all got sorted out after the war. Wilma got a letter from a gentleman. We'd been living together a number of years, but he was an old beau from high school, and he said he was coming to Montgomery, and he wanted to visit her, and he wanted to ask her a question. She wrote back and said she'd be happy to see anybody she'd gone to high school with, and so they set a date and time. I was a little worried about it, but I didn't say anything. She said, so the day arrived, and we made tea and refreshments, and about half an hour before the man was supposed to arrive, I picked up my pocketbook and headed to the door. And Wilma looked at me and said, Claudine, where are you going? She said, Wilma, this man's coming to see you. He's not coming to see us. I don't think he expects me to be here. And besides, he's going to ask you a question. She said, well, what do you think he's going to ask me? She said, Wilma, I think he's going to ask you to marry him. She said, well, Claudine, I didn't know that was what was going to happen. She said, now, Claudine, you need to put on better clothes and be sitting down on the couch next to me when this man arrives, because when he asks me to marry him, I'm going to tell him no, because I live here with you and I ain't going anyplace. She said, so the man arrived, and he looked real confused that two of them sat on the couch. And she said he ate an awful lot of cake, and he drank a lot of tea, but he never asked a question and never sent any more letters. And I figured after that, we were pretty good. Well, not long after that, Granny Ruby and Claudine both began to decline, and I was visiting them a lot. And one night during the late news, I was having coffee with Granny Ruby, and we were having a very frank discussion like we'd never had before, and I realized this was my only opportunity to ask her about what she thought of the nature of Claudine and Wilma's relationship. And so, being a good Southerner, I couched the question in euphemism as best I could. And she didn't give me much of an answer. So I pressed her a second time, and she interrupted and said, I know what you're asking me. But I don't know what to tell you. Claudine is my sister, and I love her. She's difficult, and I want to kill her most of the time. But she's my sister, and I love her. She has never been popular with men or boys, and I have never asked why. She moved in with Wilma a long time ago, and I know she loved Wilma, and I think Wilma loved her. I loved Wilma like a sister because she was kind and sweet, generous to my family, and easy to love. I have made my two oldest daughters promise that they will care for Claudine when she cannot care for herself,
as well as they will care for me. And I was amazed because Granny had made sure Claudine would stay included till the very end. Because what I had found out over the years was that it was not kindness and Christian charity that kept Aunt Claudine in our family. My grandmother had issued an edict with each of her children as they married and moved out of the house and told them, if you have a gathering, if you have a party, if you have a celebration, and you do not invite Claudine and Wilma, you need not invite your daddy and me. People said disparaging things in small groups about Aunt Claudine and Aunt Wilma, but they would not go against the family matriarch, and she knew that. Well, Granny went first, and I was devastated and lost without her. And then Claudine succumbed to dementia, and she had to go into a care facility. And my aunts did take incredible care of her. They were wonderful about it. I went to go visit Aunt Claudine one last time. Of course, I didn't know it would be the last time. And she didn't know who I was. And I knew it would stress her out if I tried to explain who I was. And I said, well, let's just say we've known each other for a long time. I said, are you good here? She said, I'm very good here. I said, do they do right by you? She said, they do very right by me. There are two women who come almost every day and make sure I have everything I need. I said, are those ladies your nieces? She said, they may be. She looked at me and she said, now who are you again? And I said, well, let's just say I knew your sister Ruby very, very well. And at the mention of Ruby's name, she brightened. And she said, well, if you knew Ruby, then I know I liked you. I hugged and kissed her goodbye, and I realized that her dementia provided her with something. She did not know that Ruby was gone. In her world, Ruby was still in the world championing her. Ruby was her sister and her champion. Family trumped everything. A few weeks later, when Aunt Claudine died, I was out of state and unable to attend her service, but I thought about her, and I thought about my grandmother, and I was reminded of a song by a group called Sweet Honey in the Rock. In that song, two women at the end of their life face each other, and one says to the other, I looked over and realized that your life had hoed the row right next to mine. And I thought about them because I know today that not only was Ruby her champion, she was mine. I'm included in my maternal family because my grandmother insisted that I be.
He's a hairdresser by trade, but he can be found telling stories at various venues all around Birmingham. Find him at his website, llsmithstoryteller.com.
You know, I talked to Lee after this event and asked him, what does your family think about you telling this story, you know, out in the public? And he said that some of them definitely feel like he's giving away the family secrets.
I get that, but I think stories like this one are the essence of what it means to be family.
Right.
Contained within them are the affection that binds the individuals into the whole. And it's that bind that really makes the blood relationship truly thicker than water.
Yeah.
I mean, that's part of the power of stories.
Yes, that's true, but it's not only true for blood relatives. Sometimes we have stories that reveal how a family is built from a much larger and diverse community. And that is absolutely the case with our next story. It comes from an event that we hosted at the Avon Theater where the theme was Back to School, Stories from Around the Classroom. Here's storyteller Trinity Williams.
Well, on February 25th, 2015, my mother passed away due to heart failure. She sort of tried to prepare my brother and I for it, but there's no really possible way that you can prepare for something like that to happen when you lose someone so close to you. I love my mother so much, and she really supported me in everything I do. Like, I play softball, and we play in the early spring, and she came out to the game one night with her blanket, sitting in the cold, and it was freezing outside. I know everybody was cold, and she was out there supporting us, and when she got too cold, she went and she sat in the car with the heat on, of course, but she was still there supporting us, so I knew that she was there, so that really helped me. And at my school where I go, you don't really see a lot of that within the school because the parents don't think they have to support once we really get to high school. They think we're old enough to hold our own. So to have her there supporting us and supporting my teammates, that really encouraged us and showed us that somebody really did care. And my mom also taught me that you should help other people. Like, there's this lady that she would go and pick up and get to clean up our house, even though my brother and I were very willing and able to clean up. But she would get the lady and she would let her clean up our house and she would pay her for it because she did need help helping out her family. And she had this little granddaughter who was about 2 or 3 at the time, and she would take her and pick her up, and we would take her and play with her. And my mom would get her clothes and whatever she needed and just send it back home with her because she just helped other people. Well, the day my mom passed, we were all at the hospital, and they told us that there really was nothing else that they could do. So I kind of knew that my brother and I were gonna go stay with my grandmother. And that kind of, it was okay with me, but I knew it was going to be a big change going from staying with my mom to staying with my grandma. But in the Black community, when people pass away, people come. Well, when the people come, the people bring food. So they would come and they would bring food. And they would come, and they would bring more food. And people kept coming and coming, and food kept coming, and the upstairs refrigerator was full of food, and the downstairs refrigerator was full of food. And I was just tired of food and people and talking and eating and all that all together. So one day, the doorbell rang, and I ran to answer the door because I love people like I always do. And my teachers were there. Well, I was tired of being sad, so, because I'm a happy person, and my mom was a happy person too, so when my teachers came, that made me happy. Because you don't really expect to see people from your school come to your house. You would expect your church members, and you'd expect your family friends, your cousins, your aunts, your uncles, but not your teachers. Who would expect their teachers to come to their house? So my teachers are there. I let them in. They came in. They sat down. We talked, and it made me really happy. And it changed my outlook of school because it showed me that school wasn't really a place where you just go to do your homework and turn it in, or you go to do your classwork and turn it in, and you go to practice, you work hard, and you just tired and you go home. School was actually a place where people cared about you, and it was a community that people actually showed that they loved you. So the next couple of days, the funeral came. And once again, I walk into the church, and I see so many people from my school. My softball team was there, my brother's baseball team was there, my principal, my teachers, and it just showed me that school isn't just school. So at the funeral, we see everybody, we get there, we see them. After there, everybody comes, they says, "I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry." And I was like, "It's okay, it's okay." And we were hugging and stuff. And the next couple of days, I was ready to go back to school because I was tired of sitting at home, just sitting up with them because my brother get on my nerves. So I was ready to go back to school. So, but nobody really thought I was ready to go back to school, but I kept telling them I was ready. So finally, they let me go back to school. And I get to school, and I know I'm walking into the lion's den of, "I'm sorry for what happened, it's okay, it's gonna be okay." And I was like, "Yeah, I know." So I get there to school, and I get a text from my friend that morning. He was like, "If you need anything, I'm there. Just text me, I'm coming running." I was like, "Good." So I get to school, I walk in, I see my teacher, my favorite teacher, she gives me a hug. I was like, yeah, it's okay. So I get to school, go to class, all that good stuff. And like just to know that I had people that were willing to come when I was ready, when I needed something, was okay because I wasn't at home with my family and I needed people there for me. So I'm at school and in class, I come to class the next day and my classmate would not let me in class to save my life. He would not let me in the classroom. So finally, they let me in the classroom and I walk in and they're just like, hey, Trinity. I was like, hey. And they're like, I'm sorry. I was like, I know. And they give me this big card and everybody in class wrote something in it. It's like, I'm sorry for your loss. Keep your head up. Stay strong. But one thing that one of my classmates wrote that I will never forget, it says, God gives the hardest fights to the strongest soldiers. Keep your head up. I was like, that's what I need. So it really just basically showed me that school isn't school. And my mom, she taught me so much, and I loved her, and I miss my mom so much. But just to know that even at school, I have people to care about me, that it really helps. And just to look back, I really think everybody should cherish the moments that you have with people because you don't really know how long you'll have them. And I think everybody should just take a look and see the relationships that you have and check and see how much they mean to you because you never know how long they'll be there. Thanks.
Of themselves. Now I know that his strength is within me.
Trinity Williams is the senior class president at Carver High School, where she also plays on the softball team. And she was the first teenager we've ever had tell at an ARC Stories event.
I remember that Trinity initially didn't want to tell a story for us because she'd be nervous, and obviously that story is very personal in nature. But you told her that the audience would completely support her through the whole thing, and they came through. I don't think we've ever had a standing ovation until Trinity told her story.
You know, I was personally so proud of Trinity, and I'm so happy that we got to play a little part in that moment. You know, young people like Trinity are essential to Birmingham's future, and we need their bravery, their vulnerability, and perhaps most importantly, that perspective.
Well, our next storyteller definitely understands both bravery and vulnerability as she finds herself in a terrifying scenario most of us can't even imagine. That's coming up in just a moment on ARC Stories Radio, Birmingham's own True Stories. Thanks for joining us for ARC Stories Radio, Birmingham's true stories told by the people who lived them and recorded in front of a live audience. I'm story coach Chris Kinsley.
And I'm ARC Stories director Taylor Robinson. When we receive submissions from people who have a story they want to tell, usually we read it, tag it with some keywords related to what it's about, and then file it away until we have a theme where we think it'll work best. However, every now and then, we receive a story that immediately sticks with us. And it leaves us wondering just where can we make it work, because this is a story that is screaming to be told. And that is absolutely the case with our last story. But first, a quick disclaimer. This story involves some adult situations. While there is nothing graphic, it does acknowledge and discuss the existence of sex. It was recorded at an event we hosted at the Avon Theater where the theme was Boo, stories to keep you up at night. Here's storyteller Ashley Bailey.
Okay, so I remember exactly where I was the day that I got the phone call. I was in the parking lot of the Purple Onion on 280, and I had just gotten some food. I was going to my car when the phone rang. So I sat in my car in the parking lot for a minute to talk. It was a new client calling me who wanted to employ my services, someone I had never talked to before, and they were offering me a large amount of money, way more money than I would normally make in a session. So my first instinct was to think, well, I've learned in this business that if you think something's too good to be true, it usually is. So I had some doubts in the back of my mind, but I was really motivated, and the money was very tempting because my boyfriend at the time was out of town, and I wanted to prove to him that I could, you know, manage the business while he was gone and make a lot of money and handle things, and he could trust me. And I guess at this point I should tell you what business we were in. It was the oldest profession there is. I was actually working as an escort. And I called him my boyfriend, but really he was my pimp. And I wanted to make this money because if we had money, then he was happy. If he was happy, then I could be okay. If he was happy, then I could, you know, take a break. And also, if he was happy, then he wasn't being violent or hurting me, and he was, you know, nice to me, kind to me. So I really wanted this to be real, and I really wanted it to be true. But still, I had my doubts, and I just kept talking to the guy, and as he talked, he told me a lot of details that started to make me relax a little bit and feel better. So he said that one of the reasons he was willing to offer me this amount of money was because he lived in Huntsville, or actually a little outside of Huntsville out in the country. So it would be quite a drive for me. And that made sense to me, and that helped me feel a little bit better. He also said that he had a very specific fantasy that he wanted to fulfill. And that was another reason he was willing to offer this amount of money. So I continued to talk to him. I talked to him so much longer than I normally would because I did have so many doubts, but he gave me so many details. He told me where he worked. He said he was in the military. He told me the exact job that he did. It was something about airplanes, I don't know, but it made me feel like he was a real person. And he told me about some other girls that he had seen, and I knew those names. I knew they were real. I'd met some of them before, so I knew, I don't know, I just started to feel like he was legitimate. So I decided that I would do it. And we set up a time for the next day. I got off the phone, I called Larry, I told him about it, my boyfriend, I told him about it, and he was so proud of me for setting up this deal, and I felt really good. And I pushed any anxiety I had down and just went with it. So the next day, I set off. When I left Birmingham, I called him just to make sure that everything was still on, that we were still good, and we were. He answered. He said, yeah, I'm here, I'm waiting. He told me exactly how to get to his house. He told me his address and very specific directions. Since it was out in the country, he gave me lots of landmarks to look for, you know, all kinds of things so that I would know exactly where I was going. He described the house, exactly what it looked like. He described the driveway. He even said that, you know, don't be alarmed, but the grass is a little overgrown because I've been out of town with my job, so I haven't had time to cut it. Oh, and the porch light is blown. But that's okay because it sort of will make this fantasy go a little bit better if it's dark. So I had some fear, but I pushed it down and I kept going. My real concern was just that it was some kind of scam and that I was going to drive up there for nothing and waste a bunch of time and not get the money. So I'm driving. I'm starting to, I get off the interstate and on all these little windy roads, and I'm passing everything. It's exactly how he said it would be. I see every landmark that he told me about. And so I'm starting to feel more comfortable because it just seems like, you know, it's real. And I'm starting to leave civilization. It's really the middle of nowhere. And at this time, it's getting dark also. I don't know where I'm going. I'm looking for his address, and I can't find it. So I try to call him again, and no signal. I can't make any phone calls at all. So now I'm getting a little bit worried. Anyway, I keep looking. I'm so determined that I'm going to find this place. So I finally find the street, the road that he told me about. I'm driving up and down the road looking for his driveway, and I cannot find it. I'm going like 5 miles an hour down the road, and I finally see his driveway. And I realize the reason I didn't see it was because there's houses on either side, a good distance away, but they're both lit up, there's people in them, and clearly there's signs of life, but his driveway is just pitch black dark right in the middle. So I turn in, and it's just how he said it was. The grass was about a foot and a half high. It was very dark, but again, that fit the fantasy. The fantasy was that he wanted to hear a knock on his door, open it, and find a naked lady just standing there waiting, ready to go, not saying a word, just ready. So I pull into the driveway, I park exactly where he tells me to park, and I try to call him one more time just to make sure, you know, we're good. And He answered. I actually got him. And he said, yeah, I'm here, I'm ready, but I'm going to hang up now because this kind of ruins the fantasy if we're talking. So we hang up. I take off all my clothes, everything, even my socks. I don't have anything on. I get out of the car. All I have is my cell phone and my keys. There's probably about 5 feet between my car door and the steps of his wooden front porch. So I get out and I kind of sprint the distance. I walk up the steps. I pull open the screen door and I knock. And nothing happens. It's completely dark. There's no sound whatsoever. I don't hear anybody moving inside. In fact, it sounds a little hollow, like there's nothing in there, but I just stand there for a second and I knock again. And still, there's nothing. There's no movement, no light comes on, no nothing. Well, at this point, I am a little nervous, but mostly I'm just really disappointed. And I just think in myself, yeah, I knew it was going to be this way. He's not here. It's some sort of scam. You know, he tricked me. I'm not going to get the money. I'm going to knock one more time. And if he doesn't come to the door, which I know he won't, I'm just going to go home. And I don't know how I'm going to explain this, but I'll just have to work extra hard tomorrow. So I knock one last time, and I stand there. I'm a little uncomfortable at this point. I'm getting cold. I'm just ready to get back in my car. I turn to start to leave, and I hear something coming up behind me. I turn all the way around, and I see this man. He's walking towards me with a flashlight from the direction of the neighbor's house. I mean, there was nothing that I could do to cover up. I have my keys and my cell phone, and this was like a long time ago, so iPhones were a lot smaller. and I was standing there thinking, like, are either of us going to acknowledge the situation here or what? But I just act like, you know, I'm talking to any neighbor, and he clearly looks me up and down, though. He's not just trying to keep his eyes on mine. And he says, ma'am, what are you doing here? And I said, well, I was supposed to meet somebody here, and they're not answering the door. I don't know what's going on, and I don't know why I'm talking to this man. But he said, you're supposed to meet somebody here at this house? And I said, yeah, I mean, this is the address, and it looks exactly how he told me it would look. I mean, I'm certain this is it. And he said, well, ma'am, nobody's lived in this house for a really long time, and I'm one of the neighbors. We keep an eye out just to make sure nobody breaks in or people don't vandalize it or whatever, but nobody lives here. And in fact, the man who did live here, he killed himself 3 years ago. At that point, I can't really even explain the feeling that I had. It was like fear just started at the top of my head and oozed down my whole body. I felt terrified, completely and totally vulnerable, no way to protect myself in the dark, in the middle of nowhere. I was frozen, completely frozen with fear. He said, ma'am, you need to get on out of here. No problem. I ran as fast as I could to my car, got in, sped down the driveway. I didn't bother to put my clothes on or anything. I just drove as fast as I could away from that place. As soon as I got back to civilization, I pulled over in a grocery store parking lot and got dressed again. I tried to call the guy several times, and it kept going straight to his voicemail, which had a different name than he had given me. I still felt terrified, and I felt like I just narrowly escaped something. I didn't know what. You know, I don't know. I still don't know if the man with the flashlight was the man. Was that really his fantasy, to see a girl be so vulnerable and scared? I don't know. Or was he really a neighbor, and did he save me from some sort of horrible fate? So I called Larry, and I cried to him, and I told him, and he said, so you didn't get the money? I said, no, I didn't get the money. And he said, well, it's okay, babe. I mean, you can just, you know, take tomorrow off, and then you can get back at it the next day. And believe it or not, I was grateful for that response. because he wasn't angry. He didn't yell at me, and, you know, I was kind of off the hook. But I'd like to say that I got out after that, but I didn't. I stayed in for another probably year and a half, but it did plant the seed, and it started to crack the foundation, and it showed me that I couldn't depend on Larry for anything. He wasn't going to protect me. He wasn't going to be there. He wasn't going to comfort me. He wasn't going to do anything I needed him to do, and the only person I could depend on was me.
Ashley Bailey is a writer and barista here in Birmingham, and you can find her on Instagram at Disappearing Violet.
I remember when we were putting this event together, and our production coordinator, Senia, told us she would quit if we didn't at least reach out to Ashley about the possibility of her telling this story. And it is easily one of the most unique and terrifying and just weird stories we've ever received. In fact, I don't think we'll ever get another one quite like it.
Oh, no. Well, whatever kind of story you've got, we'd love to hear it. Let us know by visiting our website, arcstories.com, and click on the story portal. We'd also love to have you at our next event, which is December 5th at the Avon Theater, where the theme will be "Tis the Season, Stories About the Holidays." You can get all the details at arcstories.com.
Thanks for listening to Arc Stories Radio. This program is produced in partnership with WBHM. We especially need to thank Michael Crowell, Program Director at WBHM, as well as Audrey Atkins, Marketing Manager, Will Dahlberg, Membership Manager, and Rachel Lindley, News Director. The General Manager for WBHM is Scott Hanley. Recording and mastering was by Eric Chapman from Symmetric Sound. Upper Air Creative does all of our design, and Territory 3 provides our website. Special thanks to Aaron Moon, Nate Dreger, and Jake Brantley for making this episode possible. If you like today's stories, please subscribe to our podcast. You can find it on iTunes, SoundCloud, and on our website, arcstories.com. There you can listen to other stories, stay up to date on all of our events, and even submit your own story. After all, we are always asking, what's your story?